For the next 3 days, tomorrow and Tuesday and Wednesday, I'm going to be involved in a discussion in Cullman. Brother Jim Deason has a private discussion there that with a number of preachers, and this year it's quite interesting that he, along with the editor of the Gospel Advocate, if you're not familiar with the Gospel Advocate, that is published by our institutional brethren who favor the support of human institutions, that he, along with the editor of the Advocate, have arranged a discussion for a number of men to come together and discuss our differences, and I'm to be one of the speakers there. And I am to speak on the subject of the scope of benevolence. And so I share that material with you because that's consumed me for the last couple of weeks in anticipating the questions that we may be asked. We'll have question and answer periods there. But anyway, we should have an interesting discussion on a number of issues with a number of the men of that side of the question. One of the issues that has been divisive among the non-institutional and institutional churches of Christ is the question of, can the church out of its treasury help those who are non-Christians? In the 1950s and the 1960s, when the churches were dividing over various questions, the scope of benevolence was not the dividing issue. Men like W. Curtis Porter, you hear me mention frequently, refused to debate the question. It wasn't that he did not believe that the church was limited in its benevolence, he did. But he did not believe that was the dividing issue. That was not the issue that was at hand. That was not the question that was dividing brethren across the country. And so he refused to debate the question. In time, men like A.C. Grider, who I knew personally and worked with, he was a member of the church where I preached at one time, felt that it was an issue and that it should be debated, and he did. And there's a sense in which both men were right on the question. It was an issue. Perhaps it needed to be discussed, but Porter was right. That was not the issue that was dividing churches in the 50s and in the 60s. It later became an issue. So I want to talk about the scope of benevolence tonight. That is, who can the church help out of its treasury? Who is it that should be the recipient of the church out of its treasury as the church acts as a collectivity? Let's begin with this. Let's talk about what the issue is on the question. We must always clarify the issue lest we spend time discussing things that are not a part of the question. The issue of the question of the scope of benevolence is not, should care be given to those who are in need? We all agree that care should be given to those who are in need. It is not a question, is the church obligated to some? We all agree the church is obligated to some. It is not a question, can individuals care for non-saints? We all agree that they can and they should. Fourth, it's not a question of, will care be provided for orphan children? Care will be provided for orphan children. No one questions that. Nor is the question, do non-saints deserve help? They certainly do deserve help. That's not the question. Nor is the question, what are some non-institutional brethren doing? And so it would serve very little purpose to talk about what non-institutional churches are failing to do. The charge is not true when it says they're not doing anything in benevolence, and furthermore, that's not the question or the issue. Here's the question at hand. Can the church, out of its treasury, help those who are non-saints, or can it help only saints? In other words, when somebody comes to the building, and that happens frequently, and they ask for, can the church here help us? Can we take money out of the church treasury and help that person who's not a Christian? Or should we do that as an individual if we're going to help them, if we deem they're worthy of help? That's the question. Can we send money to a non-Christian to help them in time of need? Secondly, knowing that's the question, let's raise the question about who can the church help. There are 9 New Testament passages that address the question of church benevolence out of its collectivity, that is, acting as a group from its treasury. There are only 9 New Testament passages, Acts 2, Acts 4, Acts 6, Acts 11, Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, and 1 Timothy 5. We're going to look at each one of those and take just a moment to trace through those. Let's start with Acts chapter 2. And let's take these passages and see how that these are church activity and who it was that was being helped. In Acts chapter 2, now all who believed, that is descriptive of those who are Christians, those who are saints, were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods and divided them among all as anyone had need. And what we see here is that those who believed were together, and those that believed were those that were helped. in Acts chapter 2. No one questions that. In Acts chapter 4, beginning at verse 32, we see something very similar where disciples were selling their goods. Let's see who it was that was functioning and who it was that was helped. Now, the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Notice, of those who believed. Neither did anyone among them say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but had all things in common. And with great power, the apostle gave witness to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them, that is, them who, that is, those who believed, who lacked, for all who were possessors of lands and houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they were distributed to each one as they had need. So who is it that helped? It's those who believed, who were together, and they had things in common. That's collective activity. Who was it that they helped? They helped those who believed, those who indeed were saints. Let's take another case in Acts chapter 6. No one would question it. This is church action. That is the collective action, because the apostles called the number of the disciples together, and there was a problem mentioned at verse 1. There was a complaint among the Hebrews by the Hellenists because their widows were neglected in the daily distribution. Now the 12 summoned the multitude of the disciples and said, "It is not desirable that we should leave the word of God and serve tables." So the text goes on through verse 7 saying that they should choose seven men. The church should choose seven men. That means they're functioning as a unit. Who is it that's though being helped? It is the multitude of disciples that were to look among them and help those widows that were among them, among the disciples. Let's take another case in Acts chapter 11. In Acts chapter 11, we know this was church activity, and I'll show you how as we go through. But let's see who it was that helped. In those days, the prophets came from Jerusalem to Antioch, and one of them named Agabus stood up, and he showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each one according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. And this they did and sent it, showing a collective activity, to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. And so here is collective action. And who is it that was helped? It was disciples, or it was brethren who were helped. Now let's turn to a new case, and that is in Romans 15. Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, four texts are going to be tied together, as we shall see. In Romans chapter 15, beginning at verse 25, the text says that I'm going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. For it pleased those of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are at Jerusalem. Now that's enough to make the point, and we'll come back to this passage in principle a little bit later. But Paul is saying that he was ministering, he was taking for this contribution for the poor saints who are at Jerusalem. That's who was being helped. Well, let's turn to, notice at the end, that's where I wanted to go, at the end, at verse 31, again, that it may be acceptable to the saints. It was the saints who were being helped in that contribution. Now, I want to go to 1 Corinthians 16. This is not something similar, but this is the identical case of Romans 15, the exact same case of Romans 15. And in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, so you must also do. On the first day of the week, let each of you lay by something in store. Well, obviously, this laying by in store is into the contribution. The word store is for the word from which we get our word treasury. And out of that, it was a contribution for the saints, chapter 16, 1 and 2. Now, let's go to 2 Corinthians, chapter 8, if you will. This, again, is talking about the same identical circumstance of 1 Corinthians 16 and Romans 15. In 2 Corinthians 8, beginning at verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, we make it known to you by the grace of God, the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction and abundance of their joy and the deep poverty abounded to the riches of their liberality." Now notice verse 3. "For I bear witness according to their ability, and yes, beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints." Same circumstance that we had in 1 Corinthians 16 and in Romans 15. Now, one more passage that deals with that same circumstance. Same circumstance, 2 Corinthians 9, verses 1 to 15. We don't have time to read all of the verses. "Now, concerning the ministering to the saints," that's verse 1. He said, "I'm writing about the ministering to the saints." At verse 12, "For the administration of the service not only supplies the need of the saints, but is also abounding through many thanksgiving to God." And so those four cases That is, in those four passages, talking about the same case, Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8, and 2 Corinthians 9, deal with the ministering to the saints. Now, the ninth of those nine passages is 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 16. It would do well for us to memorize verse 16 for a number of reasons, and we'll talk about those in a moment. If any man or anyone believing, man or woman believing, has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows. And what does he mean, really widows? The King James calls those widows indeed. But back up to verse 5 now. Verse 5 in 1 Timothy chapter 5. And a widow indeed, according to verse 5, is one who trusts in God. So a widow indeed is a saint or a child of God or a believer, a Christian. So what do we have? We have nine New Testament passages. We've shown that these are collective action, the church action. And those that were helped were believers or disciples or brethren or saints or a widow indeed who is one who trusts in God. Now keep in mind, these are all talking about the same case or the same event. And that's important as we come to the discussion of 2 Corinthians chapter 9 a little bit later. Now, who can the church relieve? We just listed nine New Testament passages, all under the question or under the idea that help can be given to those who are saints out of the church treasury. It was either believers or disciples or brethren or those who were saints or a widow indeed. Now, when it comes to the matter of the church taking money out of its treasury and helping non-saints, there is not a passage that teaches that. I want you to notice something very important. There is no passage that says saints only. We're quite often asked, where is the passage that says help saints only? There is not a passage that says saints only. But these nine passages only say saints. There is a difference. Now, let's parallel that to the question of what music could be offered. What kind of music can be offered? Well, we understand here are 10 New Testament passages that talk about sing, sang, song, or the fruit of our lips, or singing, or something similar to that. Here is the music that is to be offered unto God, speaking to yourselves in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Now, when we come to the question of is there any passage that authorizes instrumental music, there isn't any. But someone says, where is the passage that says sing only? There is not one. These passages do not say sing only, but they only say sing. And we can see the parallel there, and so can those who argue otherwise. Now, I know what the issue is, and I know the church can help only those who are saints. Let's see that there is a distinction between the individual responsibility and the church. That's where we're going to spend the bulk of the rest of our time. Let's begin talking about the distinction in the individual and the church by understanding the misconceptions that some have with reference to the church and the individual. What are some of those misconceptions? Well, one of the misconceptions is that the church or the individual is a church. And thus what the individual is doing, the church is doing. And so some will say, I am a church. And there are brethren who argue that I am a church. The individual is a church. And so what I'm doing, the church is doing. So any passage that applies to the individual will apply to the church, we're told. Here's another misconception. That what the individual can do, the church can do. That whatever the individual can do, the church can do. And so there is no distinction in the instructions in the New Testament to individuals. Whatever every individual can do, the church can do. Some would word that. They come from a different angle. There's another misconception, very closely related, that when individuals act, the church is acting. So whenever individuals get together and do something, then that is the church acting. So if all of us or part of us or some of us help non-saints, then the church is helping those who are non-saints. And then another misconception that we'll address coming toward the end of our study, as we'll talk about in just a moment. But let's talk about the individual and the church are not the same. And let's open our Bibles to 1 Corinthians 12, and I want us to see three principles now. I want us to see three principles that show the individual and the church are not the same. First of all, I want you to see that the body has many members. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and we'll start at verse 14. I want you to see a distinction between an individual, one person, and the church as a collectivity. Is there a difference? Well, verse 14 says, for as the body is one and has what? Many members. And all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. The body is made up of many members, a plurality of members. The individual is not many members. Now let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 12, by the way, what that was. I said verse 14, that's verse 12. Let's go now to verse 14. I want you to see the difference between a member and many members, for in fact the body is not one member but many. An individual is one member, but a church is made up of many. When it functions as a collectivity, it is many. Verse 14. Let's drop down to verse 27. At verse 27, we see, "Now you are the body of Christ and members individually." What we're seeing is a distinction, and the individual, one member, and many members. So what I'm understanding is the body has many members. There's a difference in the individual and the church. Let's see this in the case of Diotrephes in 3 John in verse 9. I want you to see there was a difference between Diotrephes and the church. "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us." He said, "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes would have nothing to do with that." What is he saying? Well, if he wrote to the church, he was writing to Diotrephes, or when he wrote to Diotrephes, he was writing to the church. That's not the point. The point is, "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes was among them." He wasn't the church. One man wasn't the church at all. Well, let's notice the role of the individual and the church are not the same. I see the body has many members. There's a difference in the individual and the church. Their role is distinct. If you don't remember any other passage, remember this one in our study tonight, and it'll be helpful in answering questions. 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 16. And I see in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16 not only a difference in the individual and the church, but the role is distinct. 1 Timothy 5:16, if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them. There's your individual. And do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows. Can you see the difference in what this individual's responsibility is and the church's responsibility? Their role is not the same. How so? The role of this individual is to take care of his own widow, and the church is not to be burdened with that. So their role is not the same. But now I want you to see a third distinction. And that is, there is a difference in individual action, individuals acting together, and collective action. How so? Well, let's turn to Matthew, the 18th chapter. You're familiar with verses 15 to 17, about if your brother sins against you, go tell him his fault between you and him alone. You remember that passage. Well, let's see what the text says. I want you to see the difference in what an individual is doing and what the church does. "Moreover, if any brother or sins against you, go tell him his fault between you and him alone, and if he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear you, to take with you one or two more, that at the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church." Now, why are you telling it to the church if this individual was the church? There's a difference in the individual and the church. There's a difference in this individual acting and the church acting over there in verse 17. But let's go a step further. I want you to notice I saw in verse 15, the individual acting. Verse 16, individuals acting. And in verse 17, the church acting. Let's see if that's not the case. Look at verse 15. "If your brother sins against you, you go tell him his fault between you and him alone." We haven't involved the church at all. "But if he won't hear you, take with you one or two more." Now we have a plurality of individuals, but they're still not functioning as a unit because you still haven't told it to the church, verse 17. So there's a difference in an individuals acting and acting together as a unit, as a collectivity. But let's go even further. I want us to talk about areas wherein individuals and the church may differ in their work and in their responsibility. Well, they differ in how their money, first of all, they differ in their work and their responsibility. We've already seen that in 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 16. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But they differ in how their money is obtained. How so? Well, let's go to James chapter 4 and verse 13. James 4:13, though talking about the question of the brevity of life, it does mention something that we are at liberty to do. To go into city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. All right, there's certainly possible that an individual could receive their money and get their money by buying and selling. That would mean I, as an individual, could go in the automotive business and have a car dealership and buy and sell cars for gain. I could be in the real estate business, or I could be in any product business where I buy and I sell and I get gain. I'm in a business operation, as many of you may be in a business operation. The church receives its money by free will contribution as per 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. So they differ in their work. We just saw that in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 16. Let's go back for a moment. Trying to show you the distinction in the individual and the church. They differ in their work, but they differ also in how their money is obtained. One can obtain their money by buying and selling. The other gains their money by free will contribution. They also differ in their name. How so? Well, the individual can wear the name Christian. If any man suffer as a Christian, any man, individual, suffer as a Christian, 1 Peter 4:16. And so you as an individual wear the name Christian. But the church as a collectivity is not a Christian, nor is it the Christian church. But God would give it the name like the Church of God at Corinth or the Churches of Christ salute you. We don't take the name Christian and apply that to the church because that's nowhere found in the pages of the New Testament. Nor is the individual a Church of God or a Church of Christ. Not at all. They differ in name. They differ in their work. They differ in their responsibility and how they gain their money. Let's talk about the difference in the individual and collective action. Now follow what we've learned so far. We've talked about some of the misconceptions. Individuals and the churches are not the same. And we saw areas wherein they differ, individual and the church differ. Now we're talking about the difference in individual and collective action. Let's illustrate that with a chain. We'll talk about the difference in individual and individuals acting and collective action. We're talking about collective action involves the church acting as a unit. We might illustrate that here with a chain. You might go to the hardware store and you might have a link, a single link of a chain. You might even find in a barrel a group of links. You might have a collection of links. You might have a plurality of those. But they're still not a chain because they're not tied together as a unit. It is not until you tie them together as a unit and functioning as a unit do we have a chain. So we might have links. We might have a link. But it's not until it's functioning together as a unit that you have a chain. Now let's take that principle and apply that to the church. We might have an individual like under the link. We might have an individual, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and in verse 14, or in verse 12, the body's not one member but many. Then you might have a group of individuals that are functioning that are not the collectivity yet. How so? Like in Matthew chapter 18 and in verse 15. But then you have the group acting together as a unit that it may relieve those who are widows indeed. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16. So there's a difference in individual action, individuals acting, and the church acting together as a unit. Now let's talk about different ways a church may function. The church may function in a collective sense, or a church may function in a distributive sense. Let me give you some examples of that. But let's first define what we mean by collective sense. A collective, according to Merriam-Webster, is denoting a number of persons or things considered as one group or a whole flock, is a collective word. When you talk about the flock, that's collective, functioning together as a unit. So a church could function as a collectivity. When we take money out of our treasury and we send money to support some preacher of the gospel, we're acting as a unit. That's collective action. We take money out of the treasury and we help someone in need. That's collective action. The church can function in a distributive sense. How so? That's referring singly, according to the dictionary, without exception to the members of a group such as each and either and none are distributed. Let's give an example in the New Testament. In 1 Timothy 5, here's a church acting as a unit. So we could say this is church action when it may relieve those who are widows indeed. That's church action. That's acting as a unit, collective action. But there is a sense in which we may say the church did something, but they're still acting not as a collectivity, but acting distributively. Case in point, Acts 8. This is where Paul made havoc of the church by hailing men and women, the text says. What else did the text say? They were scattered, according to the King James, and went everywhere preaching the word. That's those who were in the church who went everywhere preaching the word. So in a sense, it was said that the members were acting, but not as a unit. They're going everywhere scattered individually, preaching and teaching the word is what they're doing. But it was attributed to the church what they were doing. But they're not acting as a unit, they're acting distributively. That's important because we as individuals, I may take money out of my pocket and help this person, and you may take money out of your pocket and help that person, and he takes money out of his pocket and helps that person, and someone said, well, the church at El Bethel helped them. Well, in a distributive sense, we did, but not as a collectivity, not as a unit. So what have we seen? That the church and the individual differ in one member versus many, caring for their own, the church not being burdened. Individual things that should be kept private, individual matters that are told to the church, Matthew 18, buying and selling and a contribution by contrast, wearing the name, Diotrephes in the church, there's a difference between the church and the individual. These three conclusions have to be made. that if the individual and the church are not the same, the responsibility of the individual is not the responsibility of the church. So if I find in the New Testament, here's something that I as an individual have a responsibility, that doesn't mean the church has that responsibility. Secondly, what the individual does is not the actions of the church. What I do is not the actions of the church. And thirdly, passages that address individual responsibility do not apply to the church. Which brings us then to another point. Let's talk about passages that are used to justify benevolence to non-saints. There are three, and so we want to address those. One of the first that's been mentioned all through the years is James 1 and in verse 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. When the controversies came up in the 50s and the 60s, the first passage to be cited was James 1 and verse 27, that's the passage that says the church can take out of its treasury and help those that are non-saints. So let's see what James 1 and verse 27. I encourage you to get your Bible and let's turn to the context of James 1 and verse 27. James 1 and verse 27 is a passage that is addressing individual responsibility. And how do I know? Well, let's trace some of the terms that are used, the personal terms that are used in James chapter 1, beginning about verse 18. Notice that of his own he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his treasure. Verse 19, therefore, my beloved brethren, let every man, verse 19. Verse 20, for the wrath of man does not produce the wrath of God. It mentions man at verse 20. Verse 21, in interest of time, I just want you to notice the personal references. There's your souls, yourselves, verse 22. Anyone, he, man, and his, verse 23. Verse 24, he himself, man and he, verse 24. This one and he, verse 25. Anyone, he, his, and ones. Now when I come to verse 27, notice the reference to oneself or himself. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble and to keep oneself or himself unspotted from the world. The context obviously shows that this is individual responsibility, but let's go a little further with James chapter 1. I want you to notice there are two things that are mentioned here. There's a responsibility to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. The same one that is to visit is the same one that is to keep. If not, why not? Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself. Who is it that's to keep oneself unspotted from the world? Is it the church as a whole, a collectivity, or are you as an individual to keep yourself unspotted from the world? Well, I'm to do that as an individual. Whoever it is told to keep is the same one that's told to visit the orphans and the widows. Is that an individual or a church? Then notice this word oneself or himself. The oneself or himself describes an individual. And so the passage is addressing individual responsibility, and thus we've shown that individual responsibility in a church are not the same. Now let's parallel that to John 15, and what's the point? Our denominational friends through the years have gone to John 15. And in trying to affirm denominationalism, here's what they've argued. When Jesus said, I am the vine and ye are the branches, they say the branches are various denominations and various churches. I am the vine and all these churches are the different branches. And so they take John 15 and apply it to the church, or churches. Not to individuals, but to churches. And what we've shown through the years in dealing with denominationalism is that the context of John 15, the you and the you and the branch is you and you and you are the branches and anyone, these personal pronouns shows he's talking to individuals, not to churches. The same principle applies over here to James chapter 1. And so if we take this and apply it to the church, we can do the same thing with John chapter 15 as our denominational friends have done. Let's notice the second of the three passages, Galatians 6 and in verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Let's do good unto all men, especially those of the household of faith. So obviously all men is broader than just those of the household of faith. And so what is this passage talking about? Well, again, we have a passage that is addressing the individual and not the church. Let's give some evidence of that from the context and see. Notice beginning at verse 1 of Galatians chapter 6, you who are spiritual, Restore such a one, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. That sounds like an individual, doesn't it? And then let's drop down to verse 3 of the book of Galatians, chapter 6. And notice in verse 3, if anyone thinks himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Sounds like an individual, doesn't it? Well, let's drop down to verse 5. Let each one bear his own load or his own burden. Sounds like an individual responsibility, doesn't it? Well, let's notice particularly verse 7 and 8. That whatever man sows, that will he also reap. For he that sows to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. Do we reap as a church collectively or as individuals? Are we going to reap because we're in the same church? And so the church at El Bethel or the Church of Christ is going to be saved as a whole, and therefore I'm in that group? Or are we going to be saved as individuals? And then notice at verse 10, as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good. Us who? The individual's been talking about in the context. And by the way, look at verse 12. Those who are told to do good are the same ones who had been constrained to be circumcised. Well, do you circumcise individuals or churches? Well, obviously, that's something that you don't do to a church, but that's something done to individuals. Now, I want you to notice the let us do good. The us is the first person plural, which means the speaker is included in the noun class. Was Paul an individual or was he a church? Let us, churches, of which Paul, I am one. Or let us individuals do good unto all men. Let's look, notice one more passage. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 13. This is perhaps the strongest of the passages that would be used. That while through the proof of this ministry, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession to the gospel of Christ, for your liberal sharing with them and all men. And the question is, if them refers to saints, and we have to agree that it is, then the question is all men referring to non-saints? Now, this is where it's important to remember that we talked earlier about Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and 2 Corinthians chapter 9 are all talking about the same event. Not similar, but the very same event. Keep that in mind as we go further. So let's raise some points about this. First of all, when the money was raised for this event, Romans 15, parallel account. 1 Corinthians 16 says it was for the poor saints. That's what Paul said it was. He said, I'm taking the contribution for the poor saints at Jerusalem. Because I've given order to the churches of Galatia concerning the collection for the saints, 1 Corinthians 16. So when it was raised, it was said it was for saints. The context, verse 1 of our text, 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and in verse 1, the context says this was concerning the collection for the saints. Well, let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. If you're so disposed to mark things in your Bible, you might mark these verses at verse 12, 13, and 14. Whoever was relieved or helped out of this contribution, whoever the them and all men, here's something that's true about them. Verse 12 says, for the administration of the service not only supplies the need of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgiving to God. It was received and they offered thanksgiving. Whoever received it offered thanksgiving. Does that describe saints or non-saints? That is, who offer thanksgiving unto God and God accepts that prayer. Secondly, notice verse 13. Whoever received this, look at verse 13, they glorified God. Does that describe a saint or a non-saint? Whoever received it with prayer, verse 14. Does that describe a saint or does that describe a non-saint? Remember I said 2 Corinthians 8 deals with the same circumstance. So let's back up 2 Corinthians 8 in verse 4. This was called fellowship. When this contribution was sent, it was called a fellowship. Look at verse 4. Imploring with much urgency that we'd receive the gift and fellowship of the ministering of the saints. It's called fellowship. Do we have fellowship with saints or with non-saints? And by the way, look at verse 13 of chapter 9. This distribution or this sharing with all men, the word sharing is the same word koinonia, meaning fellowship. It was fellowship. So when we help those in need, we're having fellowship with them. Are we having fellowship with non-saints? So is the question is all men limited? Let's go back and try to understand 2 Corinthians 9:13. Them and all men. Is all men limited at all? Well, the word all, pontos, sometimes is used in a universal sense, like Acts 5:11. I won't take the time to read that. Or Galatians 6:10. Sometimes it's used in a limited sense, like 1 Timothy 5 and verse 20. And the question is, how is it used in 2 Corinthians chapter 9? Well, the context limits that. You say, how do you know that it's universal? The context shows it's universal. How do I know it's limited here? Because the context shows it's limited. So I have to go to the context, which we just did in 2 Corinthians 9, to know whether or not that's limited. It's limited by the context. Is it unlimited or is it limited? I have to determine that by the context. Let's notice a parallel. Look at 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 20. This is talking about elders. Those who are sinning in the presence, rebuke in the presence of all. Here we have them and all, same kind of construction. Those who are sinning refers to saints. In this case, it refers to elders, them, King James. But I want to suggest to you that there's nothing in the word all that demands it refer to non-saints. So the same principle comes to 2 Corinthians 9:13. The them refers to saints at Jerusalem. There's nothing in the all men to demand that be non-saints. More evidence of that here in just a second. Here's another parallel, Matthew 3 and in verse 5. This is most interesting to me. Then went out to him Jerusalem and all Judea. Melvin Curry observes that an interesting grammatical parallel on the part and the whole concept of 2 Corinthians 9:13 may be found in Matthew 5, 3 and in 5, which speaks of Jerusalem and all Judea. The city of Jerusalem is located within the providence of Judea. Possibly Paul might be using chi in the ascensive sense, which would yield the following translation: unto them, even unto all of them. Meaning that that's how that's used in Matthew 3 and in verse 5. So who does all men refer to? Well, let's see if we can figure that out. The them refers to the saints at Jerusalem. The all men has to have reference to other saints. I'm not going to bore you with all the quotations that I'm going to give later in my presentation. Lenski observes, though, that secondly, the saints seen as glorifying God also for the single-mindedness of your fellowship with them and with all that is other saints. And it's showing, this is not proof that that's what it means, but it shows that's a possibility of that. I'm more interested in this one right here, David Lipscomb, at least sharing that with the brethren I'm going to share it with. Lipscomb ought to mean something to them. The Lipscomb said, seeing their obedience and fidelity, he's commenting on 2 Corinthians 9:13, to the gospel of Christ, their liberality to the poor saints in Jerusalem and offering they made, prompted them to glorify God for their professed subjection to the gospel of Christ and their beneficence to all men, for their liberality showed that they excluded no Christian from their fellowship. I'm just simply showing that here are some, Lipscomb for example, that ought to mean something to the brethren I'm talking to this week, that the text means the saints at Jerusalem, or can mean, and other saints. Melvin Curry made the same kind of observation, and so did Olmanson and others make that same kind of observation. So when the text says, unto them and unto all, the idea is that the saints at Jerusalem and other saints were helped. That harmonizes with everything we see. Let's finally close with this, and the lesson will be yours. I want to suggest to you that we all believe in some form of limited benevolence. We are ridiculed, and I will be this week, I'm sure, for believing in a limited scope of benevolence. But those that I will be talking to and contending with, they also believe in limited benevolence. How so? They do not believe the church can take money out of its treasury and help a lazy man, because if a man will not work, neither should he eat. They don't think you ought to help him. Nor do they think the church can relieve and help the individual's widow. If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged. You say, well, what's the point about that? Well, that doesn't mean that anyone's heartless, does it? You see, if I think the church ought to not take money out of its treasury and help this person, doesn't mean I don't think they ought to be helped. I just don't think it ought to come out of the church treasury. That I'll help them as an individual, and so will you. But that doesn't mean we're heartless. Any more than are you heartless because you're not going to take money out of the treasury and help this widow, or you're not going to help this lazy man? Nor does that mean that we don't believe in helping the needy. Could I say, well, because you don't believe in helping this one and helping this one, you don't believe in helping the needy? That's by the charge. That's been the charge, by the way, that some of these churches are those that don't believe in helping needy people. That charge has been made about this church and a host of other churches like us. And if you haven't heard that, you haven't been out on the fray of meeting those kinds of contentions that are made. They make that about us. They say they don't believe in helping the needy. Well, do they not believe in helping the needy? Well, they believe in limited benevolence. It doesn't mean the church can't relieve some. The church can relieve some, just can't relieve those. They believe in limited benevolence. And most importantly, it means emotional pleas are going to apply to these as well. When somebody talks about that poor, starving orphan that is left on the doorstep, and you're not going to take money out of the treasury to help them? No, but I'll take my money. And I'll guarantee if we walked out the door and there's a poor, starving orphan on the door, I'll guarantee you we could have $10,000 within a matter of 5 minutes out of this crowd. I'll guarantee it. We'll have it in a short time to take care of that orphan. Money would pour in individually, but we're not taking any money out of the church treasury. But the emotional plea about that can apply to this one. You mean you're going to let this orphan, this individual's widow, starve to death? No. He's not going to take money out of the church treasury. You mean you're not going to let this man right here, that you're just going to let him starve? You're not going to take money out of the church treasury. Emotional pleas apply to that just as it does to everything else. Well, I appreciate you bearing through that. If that was the kind of material that you felt like you had to endure, I've been enduring this for 3 weeks and will for 2 or 3 more days. So share in my burden, please. This is an issue that is important, but it is not the most important of the issues that divide brethren, but hopefully you come to a better understanding of what the issue is on the scope of benevolence, who the church can help. There's a distinction in the individual and the church. These passages used to justify benevolence to non-saints don't fit, and we need to understand that all of us believe in some form of limited benevolence. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come this evening believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?